The distinguished sociologist of science, famous for provocative views about what science is and isn't, who is going to be talking to us about his 30-year study of the history of gravitational wave astronomy. And then on Wednesday, we have Philip Vanheim, which also will be a provocative talk with the title of Dark Matter and Dark Energy, Atoms or Fiction. Then the following Wednesday, we have a colloquium talk, also on cosmology, by Peter Coles, who has recently moved, I think, to a chair of cosmology at Nottingham. And then there will be a schedule for December and so on. Meanwhile, tomorrow, there is a great string seminar. There is a great quantum gravity seminar. And on top of that, there is the beginning of a meeting that we are having here at Canadian Institute for Advanced Research, meeting on quantum materials with many distinguished condensed matter physicists. And the talks are on the website starting tomorrow. There are many good talks there. Friday, we have the launch, the start of another workshop on the emergence of space-time, and these coincide purposefully because there is a lot of condensed matter physics in there. These are condensed matter physicists playing around, being interested in what space-time is. We have a day of talks starting on Friday. The full titles are on the webpage, but studying the notion of the emergence of space-time from different points of view, from quantum information theory to string theory. And then finally, we have a special joint colloquium with Wilfrid Laurier. This is the initiation of that program at 4:15 on Friday with Seth Floyd, Universes of Quantum Computer. So it's busy days. And we're very, very pleased to have here from Adelaide, Sundance Bilson Thompson. He's been visiting for 3 weeks, and he's going to tell us about topological prion models.
Okay, well, thank you for the introduction, Lee. And I'd also, at the outset, like to thank Lee and the Perimeter Institute for inviting me here. So, I'm going to be talking about topological prion models. Now, at the very outset, I want to make one point. Most people these days haven't really heard of prion models. So when you say working on prion models, they think of something like this. That's not what I'm talking about today. Okay. Prions were proposed subcomponents of quarks and leptons. And I'm going to be talking about some of the shortcomings of the standard model and why we want to propose prions. I'll look at one specific prion model, the Richon model, and then my own particular model, which is the development of this, that I call the Helon model. I'll delve into some of the phenomenology and systematics of the Helon model. Then very briefly explore the possible connection with quantum gravity, which is what I've been doing in a couple of weeks that I've been here so far, and round it up with a bit of discussion of unanswered questions, directions for future work, and some conclusions, possibly inconclusions. So we'll start off with the stuff we all know from kindergarten. In one slide, here's the standard model. We've got quarks and leptons. Leptons carrying integer charge, quarks carrying fractional charge, which is in units of exactly 1/3 the charge on, say, the electron. For some reason, this pattern is reproduced in at least 3 generations. There are 4 known forces, the electromagnetic weak, color, and gravity, which of course is problematic when you want to combine these. And the quarks carry color charge, the leptons don't. Fine and good so far. Now, this is great, and the standard model makes a lot of very accurate predictions, but we really don't get any insight from it as to why there should be 3 colours, why there should be 4 forces rather than some other number, you know, why aren't there 6 colours or 8 colours or whatever, why are there 3 generations of particles, and are there more than 3 generations, and why do the electric charges of the electron and the proton balance up so precisely. There are also a series of parameters and rules which don't seem to come from anywhere. We just have to plug them by hand. The strengths of couplings, weak mixing angles, the fact that colored particles have fractional electric charge, but leptons are not colored, and the fact that colored particles are confined. Why should that be? So a lot of people have tried to go beyond the standard model and delve into some sort of an explanation of what's going on there. For instance, there's been supersymmetry, string theory, and theory, and we could get into a very long and involved discussion about the merits and pros and cons of these approaches. But the bottom line, at least for me, is that anything where suggesting extra particles, extra dimensions, extra forces, which haven't been suggested, which haven't been detected, should at least be considered a little bit dubious on the basis of Occam's razor, if nothing else. And it seems like this is just swapping old questions for new questions. So people also have investigated the idea of regarding quarks and leptons as composite and saying that the properties of the standard model arise from this composite structure. The first such model was proposed by Paddy and Salam in 1974. It involved subcomponents called prions, from which we get the name. That's basically been carried over as a generic name for all subcomponent theories or models. In 1979, a particular prion model called the Richon model was proposed independently and pretty much simultaneously by Harari and Shoup. They actually published in the same issue of the same journal on consecutive pages. So either there was some weird psychic thing going on or it was a really cool coincidence. Anyway, but Harari was published first, so he usually gets quoted as the person who invented it. So that says something about how fair history is. Okay, so there are problems with the prion models as well, which I try to delve into as follows. So composite approaches generally work in the past. We've gone from an understanding of the world being composed of objects down to being composed of combinations of molecules. They're made of atoms, they're made of nuclei and electrons. The nuclei are made of nucleons, and the nucleons are made of quarks. So even though there's no direct evidence for substructure in quarks and leptons, it still seems like this is the least radical proposal if we want to go somewhere else. So let's try it again. So this is the Richon model, proposed in 1974, the Quip model. The Quips was Shoup's notation, it's short for quark in a parts. Quark in a parts, yeah. So
parts.
Forks.
Forks.
Yeah.
Not
forks.
Parts. P-A-R-T. In a parts. Not the kind of parts that you go skateboarding and jogging in. P-A-R-T-S. Okay. So in this model, the first generation of quarks and leptons were described as triplets of spin half objects called either Richons or Quips, which come in two varieties using Harari's notation. Those varieties were named T and V, and the corresponding antiparticles, T bar and V bar. The T's carried charge of plus one third the charge on the electron, well, on the proton actually. T bars carry the opposite charge. V's and V bars are neutral, but V's and V bars were actually considered to be distinct particles. Right? They are antiparticles of each other. Now, if you assume that these things can combine into triplets, if you assume that the ordering of the three Richons within a triplet matters, and if you assume that you can't mix anti-Richons and Richons together in the same triplet, then you get the following possible combinations. When you have three Richons that are all the same type, there's only one possible permutation you can form with a charge of exactly plus or minus E, so in case of the three T bars or three T's. If you have three V's or three V bars, you get a charge of exactly zero. But when you have a mixture of T's and V's or T bars and V bars, then because of the assumption of the ordering matters, you can have three possible permutations. And Shoup and Harari identified these three permutations with colour charge, which was quite a nice little idea because it explained why the particles that have fractional charge also carry colour charge, and the ones that have integer charge don't. Note also that richons don't always form fermions, anti-richons don't always make anti-fermions. So in this case, what have we got? We've got, say, an anti-up being formed from T-bars and V-bars, but a down being formed from also from T-bars and V-bars.
What are the statistics of this?
Are you talking about how the spins relate?
Yes, those are funny.
Yeah, they're all assumed to be spin half. Right, so they have to obey fermion statistics.
Okay, so but then the ordering, I mean, you said the ordering matters, so why, how can you get three different
functions for that? The fact the ordering matters is just an assumption. I think you'd have to look back at one of the original papers to see if they came up with a way of dealing with that. I think they scratch my head here and say, very hand waved past us in the original papers and then tried to propose an explanation for it. In 1981, there was an extension which introduced more quantum numbers that Harari brought in, which tried to explain the spin statistics properly. But I'll get to that in a second.
Sorry, the first one for you, Bob, in the top right hand corner. Is that misprint? Should that be TVT?
Sorry, I said
it. The top right hand corner of the table. That would be TVT.
Sorry, it should be two T's. Two T bars and a V.
So then what do you mean by the ordering matters then? Are you saying any of those three possibilities are being identified?
Yeah, I'm saying that if you take, say, T bar, V bar, and V bar, or T, V bar, and T bar, that those will actually be separate particles. It's not like taking, say, two protons and three neutrons and putting them together and getting a helium nucleus, and it doesn't matter how you put them together. I'm saying that, or Harari and Shoup were saying, that there was actually some distinction between which particle was first, second, and third if you wrote them down in a triple.
Why? Like, because they're all going to be the octopart.
What was it?
Colors.
Right.
They're the colors.
So.
Well, I think later on they get a color.
You don't
Right. No, this was the first attempt.
Okay. So the pros of this idea were that there was an explanation for the number and type of fermions in the first generation. There was an explanation for why fractionally charged objects had colour. And intriguingly, there's no matter-antimatter asymmetry. If you look at the Big Bang and say, why is there more matter now and antimatter in the universe, the question just goes away. If the universe is electrically neutral, then there are equal amounts of richons and anti-richons in the universe. One of the disadvantages, which we're sort of headed towards at the moment, is labeling these things first, second, third is just as arbitrary as saying colour. So it really doesn't get us anywhere. It's a nice idea, but if you poke it and prod it a bit, it breaks pretty rapidly. Like I said, there's no experiment that's a substructure. And you need some explanation for why you don't get spin through half groups formed. So in 1981, Harari proposed a set of dynamics and said that you've got to have a conservative approach, which was to just stick with the gauge theory idea. So he introduced a quantum number called hypercolor, said that each of these richons and anti-richons could carry hypercolor, they can be members of hypercolor threes or three bars. But also they had to carry color in order for this to work. Then the triplets are bound as hypercolor singlets, and the combinations of color that you get within those triplets give you the color of the fermion that you formed, the core that formed. Now, it's pretty easy to see if you start to count up the possible number of particles with, you know, hyper red, hyper green, hyper blue, and red, green, and blue, and so on, that you wind up with, well, A, you need hyper gluons of some sort to carry this force, so you're not really gaining anything, and you wind up with a greater number of particles than you actually have in a standard model. So you've lost all of the benefits of trying to simplify in the first place. So Harari's other idea was we could be conservative or we could be radical. We could come up with some sort of different approach. The conservative one didn't work. That was the set of affairs in about 1981. Gradually, people lost interest in prions for various reasons, including the fact that these things became more complicated than what they were trying to explain. But they did start off reasonably well. It was a nice, elegant idea to begin with. So let's try a radical proposal and see where it gets us. And my radical proposal is that rather than treating our fundamental objects as points, we treat them as lines. Okay. So consider two lines. What can we do with them? They can run parallel to each other, or they can cross over each other. They can go in a left-hand sense or a right-hand sense. Now that's equivalent to taking, say, a strand of material and just putting a twist, pi or minus pi, in that piece of material. Now, so there's two varieties, left-handed and right-handed. I like to call them duns and d's, and they use the generic name Tweedles for these things. Unfortunately, referees don't share my sense of humour, but anyway. So if we combine pairs of Tweedles, we get three possible composite states. Two d's give us an h plus. Two duns give us an h minus. And a dun and a d, or a d and a dun, ordering doesn't matter in this case, give us an h naught. In other words, we've got full 2pi rotation one way, full 2pi rotation the other way, or no rotation. That's just three possible varieties. Right? So, twist 2 plus or minus pi. These pairs are like little helices, so that's why I call them helons. And here's a little diagram showing how we can combine pairs. We get either no twist, full 2pi twist to the left or to the right. Now, we can then make the association with the Richon model of saying that the T bars, the T's are the H pluses, or I think I've got this labeled the wrong way around. The T bars would be the H pluses, the T's would be the H minuses, and the V's would be equivalent to the V bars. They're both identified with the H naught. So we're back to the starting point of the Richon model, but with the slight modification that there's no distinction between V's and anti-V's in this case. So we'll now consider that we've got a triplet of these things. We can visualize those as having three strands connected at the top and bottom, connected to a pair of discs. In the simplest case, this structure can be rotated through 120 degrees anyway, and you can't distinguish those rotations, right? There's a symmetry there. But there's no reason why these things can't cross over each other. If you do that, then you can start to form braids, and all of a sudden, that rotational symmetry is gone. You can look at the total structure and say, rotate it through an arbitrary angle and still identify which strand is which, because you can count how it crosses over or under its fellows. Right? So there's no need to actually make the assumption, which was put into the Richon model a priori, that the ordering matters. You can actually create a situation in which the ordering matters without it being an initial assumption. Okay. Now, remember that each of these helons can be of three types, which are equivalent, if we take the mapping along to the Richon model, of charges of plus eon 3, minus eon 3, or zero. So, like the original model, these things don't carry colour. The ordering determines the colour of a triplet, but unlike the original Richon model, we have a reason why the ordering matters. Now, we'll make the same assumption that was made in the original model, that is, we can't mix plus and minus charges together. And then we get the following possible combinations. Okay? So we get one combination that gives us an E plus, one that gives us a neutrino, one that gives us an E minus. Then we have three possible permutations that have a charge of plus 2/3. and so on for the other remaining combinations where there's one odd man out. And we have the three distinct permutations, so we have the three color charges, just like in the original neutron model. But there's a gap here. We're missing the anti-neutrino, and that's come about because we've made the identification that V is the same as anti-V. Okay. So there's the recap. Tweedledee form H pluses, H minuses, and H naughts. The cost is that we have two levels of subparticles within quarks and leptons rather than just one. But the payoff is that we can explain the existence of all the quarks and leptons except the anti-neutrino. We can explain why the charge ratios of quarks and leptons are exactly 1 to 2 to 3. We can explain the existence of color charges. We can explain why only colored objects have fractional electric charge. And the charge is quantized. If you look at these twists, they're either there or they're not. If you look at two strands, they've either crossed over each other or they haven't. Now, so the Richelmans were assumed to carry quantum numbers of spin and electric charge, and by 1981, type color as well. We don't do that, right? There's no assumed charges, spins, masses, anything, right? We've just got a single line object that we wrap around its fellows.
In the Richelman model, there's an assumption that the Richelmans and non-Richelmans, they do not, they cannot be together, right?
Correct.
But then in your Brady model, is this assumption become a natural thing, or is it still an assumption?
At this stage, it's an assumption. We're working on a way of making it a natural feature of the model. But it's not completely, you know, bulletproof yet. So these are the three assumptions that we're working with. We've got pairs, the pairs form triplets, and there's no charge mixing.
So then the hypercolor was combined the Richelmans?
Yeah, the hypercolor provided the binding, so that the Richelmans form hypercolor singlets. But then you still had exposed color.
Right.
Because the Richelmans in the 1982-81 version have hypercolor and ordinary color, so it was formed an SU3 hypercolor cross SU3 color combination. Okay. Now, we're dealing with braids, and one of the first things that you do with braids is form the braid group. Right? Treat braids as elements, then define a multiplication process which involves splitting and joining these braids together to join them top to bottom, right? When we do that, if we make a sort of arbitrary choice to say this thing that looks like this is a braid and it's mirror image top to bottom, we'll call an anti-braid, right? For the sake of convenience. Assign a number where you count the number of braids and count the number of anti-braids, join these things together, and there's a number which is conserved, which is the total braid number, right? So if you take a braid and top to bottom mirror image, put them together, then you can flatten it out to a trivial structure like this, okay? So the number of braids minus the number of anti-braids gives you a conserved total braid number. So we can construct the first generation of fermions from the positive and null twists on a braid. So we take each one of these braid structures and add either 0, 1, 2, or 3 positive charges by just twisting one of those strands, okay? So that gives us antineutrinos, anti-downs, ups, and positrons. And we can also mirror those left to right, right? We can construct a braid pretty much in an arbitrary manner. We'll now construct the antiparticles as top to bottom mirror images. So you'll notice that this braid here is the top to bottom mirror image of this braid here, and the charges on it are all negative rather than positive. So if we join this braid with this braid, the braiding crosses out, cancels out, right? We get back to a trivial structure, and all of the charges should cancel out as well. So it looks something like particle antiparticle annihilation, right? And of course we could do the reverse process, which would give us pair production. Okay, so the lesson to take away from this is that all fermions are essentially neutrinos with some amount of electric charge hung onto the underlying neutrino framework. Now, the left-right mirroring of a braid or an braid gives us something that we can interpret as helicity, right? We'll say this is a left or right-handed version of an electron or a quark or whatever. The top-to-bottom mirroring gave us particles and antiparticles. Now, for each non-zero value of the net charge on a triplet, there are four possible combinations that we can make for charge and helicity. So I'll just sit back there, right? So we had a net, here we've got an absolute value of, say, 3/3, right? So we can have this, 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 or this, four possibilities, right? Which corresponds with this, 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 and this. But because there's only one type of negative of neutral structure, there are only two possible helicity states that we can make that are neutral. And it's natural to split those in half and say one of them is the neutrino, one of them is the antineutrino. So we've got half as many states for the neutral fermions as for the charged fermions, which is exactly what we want. And that comes about because we made the identification of V being equivalent to anti-V. So now let's have a quick look at the quantum numbers that pop up. Let's assign a number beta plus 1 to braid. So that's all the stuff that was on the top row of the diagram I showed. And beta equals minus 1 for the stuff on the bottom. And we'll define this quantity, omega, to be 1/3 the number of more positive helons minus 1/3 the number of less positive helons. So in other words, the H pluses are more positive than the H naughts, and the H naughts are more positive than the H minuses. And we'll let n of x be the number of objects of type x. So n of h plus is just the number of h pluses. Then omega obeys this relation here. And the charge of any fermion is given by this relation here. The magic comes when we combine these two and find that the charge can be expressed as simply a half beta plus omega. Now, if you actually count through each one of those possibilities and figure out what the values of beta are, you find that beta on 2 reproduces the third component of isospin, and omega is equivalent to hypercharge for the quarks. And those roles get reversed when you look at the leptons. And therefore, what we've really got, if we plug these quantities in, is just the Gell-Mann-Chajima relation. Right? For both strong hypercharge and the equivalent relation to this for weak hypercharge. Okay, it works for both. There's no apparent equivalence to strangeness, charm, bottomness, topness, electron number, muon number, or tau number. I haven't really dealt with higher generations yet, but all of this stuff is just constructed on the number of H pluses and H naughts and H minuses. Right? There's nothing that takes into account some generational structure. So if we let beta of x be the beta value associated with fermions of type x, we can also define this quantity, right, which turns out to be just the lepton number. And we can equate that back to the total number of braids and antibraids, right, and find that they're the same thing. Since we know that the total number of braids and antibraids is conserved when we split and join, that means the lepton number must be conserved. And we can do an equivalent argument with quarks and baryon number. So, I mentioned the second and third generation fermions. How are we going to explain their existence? Well, we can have a more complicated braiding pattern. That's the most sensible approach for starters. So these braids that I've shown here are just for example. We don't necessarily want to say that this is exactly what the braid structure for any higher generations would look like, but it's an illustration of the concept. So here's a first generation fermion, here's a second generation fermion, here's a third generation fermion. Just add more, don't add more braids to the strands, braids to the group, right? You still have just three helons, and they form, so they still form triplets, but make them cross over in more and more complicated structures. Now, this process of joining the braids top to bottom forms a nice little illustration of weak interactions. If you investigate it, you find that when you join these guys top to bottom to form the braid product, then the twists can spread up and down the strands. charges to be exchanged and either cancel out or form in opposite pairs and split apart. So we can turn up quarks into downs, electrons into neutrinos, and so on. So here we've got an example where we have an up quark combined, joining with an electron, exchanging some charge, and it turns into a down and a neutrino. Right. Notice that the position of the odd man out in this triplet up here hasn't changed. So here the odd man out is over on the far left span. In this case, the odd man out is also on the far left span. It's a different odd man out. Right now, it's an H minus instead of an H north, but it's in the same position, which means that the colour of the original up quark and the final down quark is the same. Now, extend this to muon decay. So let's take a more complicated grading structure, right, and say this is a second generation object with three H minuses, so it's a muon. We could split off those three charges into a trivial structure here. That trivial structure can then cross itself over, but every time you have a strand crossing it one way, it has to cross back the other way at the other end. If you split down the middle, you then get two mirror image braids, right? And this one carries away all the charge in this case. So what we've got is a muon going to an uncharged second generation structure, a muon neutrino. And then this looks like it's basically a W minus going off and decaying into an electron and an antineutrino. All very simple, right? Very, really, really basic sort of topology. But it reproduces this nice feature that this lepton is linked to another lepton of the same generation, which was really the original observation that led to the discovery of the second and third generation in the first place.
Is there any reason why I should stop at three?
Mm-hmm. At having three strands in a...
Yeah, one of four families.
No, you mean three breaks.
Three breaks, sorry.
Yeah, you mean three strands within the...
We
can't actually say that there is some reason to stop at three. We know that there are three observed generations in the real world, but one of the things that we'd like to find is some sort of governing rule that says this is how you construct each successive generation. That puts certain constraints on what the grading patterns should be, and that would imply a constraint of some sort of condition that you figure out if there is a fourth generation or a fifth generation.
But playing this game, again, just the previous slide,
yeah.
Could you actually come up with an interaction that would give you one more generation? Is there anything ruling that out?
Apart from the fact that if you built more. Yeah, so if you have some extra pattern of twisting forming here and then something splits off, yeah, it would be conceivable that you could do that, I guess. You could, yeah, like I said, it depends exactly on how the higher generations are formed. Like I said, the forms that I showed in the previous slide were just examples. So the first generation is really easy to form. You just go for the simplest pattern that's not going to just fall apart, that kind of unravel itself. I mean, if you took, say, two strands and put them side by side, twisted them around each other, and then let them go, they'll just spring back out into the equivalent of a closed ring. If you take three, then you can start to break them around each other and form something that won't fall apart. So forming the first generation is easy. You just take the simplest structure that won't deform itself off into two particles. Forming a second or third generation is a bit more tricky. So, yeah, the rules of government aren't completely clear yet. Okay, so the weak interaction suggests that the bosons are braids, which, well, they look like trivial braids in this case, but we want to be a bit more general than that and say that they're just braids that induce a trivial permutation between the top and bottom of each strand, right? So basically, strand one goes down to strand one, strand two goes down to strand two, strand three goes down to strand three. So the simplest case is the trivial example here, where we can have three pluses forming a W plus, three minuses forming a W minus, and this kind of superposition of a W plus and W minus forming a Z naught. And these are, of course, formed by just joining the top and bottom mirror image braids from the earlier slide. Like I said, though, other brains which induce trivial permutations are possible, or identity permutation are possible in principle. So, for example, you could have something like this, where this strand starts off on the far right, goes back to the far right. This one starts on the far left, goes back to the far left, and so on. So, gluons we can construct by weakening our condition about not having pluses and minus mixing, right? So we can form permutations of pluses and minuses and zeros, which will give us gluons. Interact those with the fermion, and you change the colour. So if you take an up quark, interact it with something that's got a plus and minus on it, and you'll change the colour. And a photon can just be something like this with no charge carried on it. Now, to be consistent with GWS, we should really say that we're not talking about Z0 and the photon, we're talking about the W0 and the B, which combine it, you know, to produce the Z0 and the photon that we observe in the real world. And then we have to worry about the Weinberg angle. But conceptually, nothing here changes with the general underlying idea.
So, is there any reason why we've chosen this particular braid to represent the photon, or is it just randomly chosen?
This particular braid here, I've chosen that one because you can form it from, I think, the diagram that I had before where we had a braid there and another braid there and then corresponding mirror images here, right? The trivial ones are formed by taking two braids that are up or below each other and joining them together. That pattern there is formed by taking two that are side to side and combining them, and that also gives you the identity permutation constraints. So that was the justification for using that particular diagram. So that's the colouring in there, the weak interaction, sorry. Now we're going to have a look at the colour interaction, and we're going to introduce one more assumption here, which is to say that we require the same charge to be visible on all three strands in a triplet. Okay. Leptons already fulfil this trivially, the quarks don't, but quarks can kind of cheat, and the way you can visualise this is to say if you take a few quarks and stack them on top of each other, take these braids and stack them one on top of the other so that the strands line up, then each of those strands that lies on top of each other forms a sort of super strand with a charge which is equivalent to the sum of the charges on each strand. So here, this strand here and this strand here lie over each other, and they look like a net negative object. Play this game, and here I've just written out the three demons in ordered triplets for the sake of convenience. Play this game, start off with one quark of some colour, and then pick how you can satisfy this assumption. And you pretty automatically find that you have to either make pairs in which you have colour and a corresponding anti-colour, or you make triplets where you sort of run through this flowchart here and you wind up with one of each colour. So you wind up with a colour signal there. And in some cases, in one case you get a neutral, sorry, in two of these cases you get a net neutral triplet, in the other you get a net single positive charge triplet. Right, so you get something that looks like a neutron, something like a proton. Okay, so the story so far is that we have all the right fermions with all the right charges. We've got only left-handed neutrinos and right-handed antineutrinos. We've got all the right bosons. We've got electroweak and colour interactions. We've got a bunch of conservation laws, and we have correspondence with some of the known quantum numbers. Now, if only we had gravity, that would just be greedy. Well, if there's one thing we learned from living through the 1980s, it's this. Okay. So, what seems to be the most promising approach at the moment? Oh, sorry. But
since you're going on to gravity, maybe I can ask a couple of questions on what you did up till now.
Mm. One is,
we know the neutrino has mass, so how is that? How does that fit in here? Because your last slide seemed to indicate that it couldn't have mass.
Technically, we don't know that the electron neutrino has mass. We know that there's a mass difference between the three generations of neutrinos, but we don't know absolutely that the electron neutrino has a non-zero mass.
So with this model, your higher generations won't have this property of having a unique list. Your higher generation neutrino.
Presumably not, no.
I see. The other question was on your Z naught. I didn't understand why the pluses and minuses just didn't cancel out from that little model you had.
That's a little bit hand wavy. That's sort of my way of representing the Z naught as kind of a superposition, I suppose. What exactly do you mean by a superposition? It's something which is as obviously classical as this model, which you can just, you know, do with pieces of paper, is tricky. But it needs to be some way of distinguishing the Z naught from the photon, such that the Z naught and the photon can actually deform into each other, so that you have something analogous to Weinberg mixing. That was the best idea I could come up with. But if someone comes up with a better idea, I'm certainly happy to hear it.
And also, are we supposed to think of these things as actual little boxes? I mean, what are the top and the bottom of those diagrams?
Why
can't I rotate the top, for example? Okay. By a third of a turn, is that still a valid top?
Identification. You could take the top and rotate it around by a third of a turn, say, but that wouldn't actually change some inherent feature which says that this thing is rated.
But it might change the composition laws when you take them. New ways of sticking.
You're worried that it might change the rules for when you join these things at the bottom. Yeah. Can we leave that discussion until after the talk? I mean, I appreciate the point. But it might be something that's better dealt with by first delving into the work that I've been doing here and possibly connecting this with quantum gravity, and then maybe having a bit more of a discussion about the possibilities that might arise from that.
Can I ask also a question? So if your purpose here is to reproduce the features of the standard model, you also have to come up with calculational rules that allow me or anybody to calculate transition amplitudes that would match cross-section calculation and so on. So do you have simple dynamical rules for your grades that would allow me to build up a new standard model?
Once again, let me answer that by going to the next section of the talk and then coming back to it.
An easier question then, just at the level that you've been talking about, I think it's clear you've just got two crossings, my question is, you get the particles you want, but are you sure you're not predicting other particles that you don't want? Right, so in other words, I think if you've just got two crossings, then you've just got the four possibilities for that template, plus or minus crossings, and you've enumerated all those. Right, so you claim you've got the right pattern of the first generation.
Yep.
But the second generation, is it clear that you're taking a particular template and then saying with three grades, now you've got eight possibilities. So it seems like the second generation is going to be bigger than you're predicting. It may contain what you want, but it may contain more and more.
Okay. The possibility, right, the number of possible states with particular charges, right, so you can have, in any group of three helions, you're always going to have no charge, one, you know, eon 3, 2 eon 3, or e. The question of whether or not you form other states with other crossings, that delves back to the question earlier about how we form higher generations and whether there's constraints which stop us forming, say, a fourth generation or a fifth generation or not. And it's a very good question, which we don't have an iron proof, cast. But there might be some connection there with Covivo mixing. The fact that you can construct higher generations in several different ways somehow destabilizes them, rather than producing new particles. It just destabilizes the higher generations and allows things like the charm and strange force to decay down to the first generation somehow. And that's a speculation.
Continuing on that question, you were characterizing this higher generation by some quantum numbers. They were commutative quantum numbers, or accounting the number of plus 3.
Sorry, can you speak up?
They were commutative quantum numbers. But, since you're using grades, These quantum numbers do not fully characterize which bridge you're thinking about, because depending on how you put your crossings and how you put your charge, you will get different topological structures that will carry the same numbers you were talking about. So it seems to me you need the mechanisms to identify these different things.
That's a point I appreciate, but if we were eventually to start writing down all the possible structures that you can form, it would take far too long in the middle of a colloquy. But yes, you're quite right. But it's, once again, a topic that should maybe be dealt with after the colloquy and rather than in the middle of it.
But the point is, it's not solved. We don't want to necessarily the answer. There isn't the status of the work is that it's not solved. It's
Okay. And the status is related to all those questions and also amplitudes of mind. That the model that I've just presented, right, that's really a static model. It gives you some structures that don't really change. There's no real dynamics built in there. The hope is that by doing some other trick, we can get some dynamics in there, we can figure out what amplitudes we get for certain processes and so on. And that's at least in part what I'm going to look at for this stage.
Yeah, before you start to doubt it, maybe I should just come back from the fact that people may wonder why there haven't been a paper since 1981, which is 24 years ago. And the main reason I think is something that I mentioned is something called the trophic anomaly matching. Conditions. I don't know if the people are familiar with that. But the Trotsky in 1979 gave an argument which you may evade in what it didn't involve gravity at all. But with certain assumptions that the, for example, the Richon model, if you assume the Richons are confined in a gauge theory, they transform, as say, a fundamental of a gauge group. And quarks and leptons are made of three prions, three spin and a half prions. There's an argument, which is too complicated to explain now, but it's very rigorous, that there is no, the number of prions you need is not an integer or something that solves the Bernoulli equations. And I think this, it was suggested in 1979, it took several years for the community to realize how general it was, but I think that's why people start to stop working on prions. And that's a criticism of the Richon model, not of your model, which probably interesting. But I think whatever you do, you have to convince people that you're evading that criticism.
I think the most honest answer I can give at this stage is that we think it's possible we might evade those criticisms. We don't know for certain.
But I think we have to address them because that's in people's minds.
We have to address them, but I think that what's being done in this model is sufficiently different from what was done back in the early 80s that people shouldn't just automatically say, well, because of the Hooft anomaly condition, that doesn't work, and dismiss it out of hand.
But
we should definitely.
I think the Richon model doesn't work a la Harari.
No, we definitely do have to address those issues at some stage. But I think that we've probably got a bit more wiggle room than any of the other models. Mm-hmm. All right, so moving on at this stage, this is basically a boiled down version of what I've been doing with Platini and Lee in the couple of weeks that I've been here so far. What we've tried to do basically is modify spin networks that you get in loop quantum gravity, rather than saying we have networks where each link in the network carries some SU2 labels. We've done away with that. We don't have spin on the links, which is equivalent, I suppose, to saying taking the Richon model, which had spin on each of the Richons, and doing away with that, saying that the elons don't have spin. And the links, rather than simply being one-dimensional connections from one point to another, in some sort of embedding within some manifold, we'll treat them as ribbons. So in other words, they're framed. We can distinguish a left and right edge from them. Then we just carry over sort of moves that you get in with quantum gravity, where you can take one vertex and change it around. So in this case, once again, we're dealing with ribbons rather than single line, but we've got a move like this, where you take, say, these two legs down here and these two legs down here, connected by a joint that goes across horizontally like so, and then move that around to the point, so the joint goes vertical. So to be precise, I should really have included some sort of a bad spot that people normally have. I should really have included something on the diagram which indicates that the link goes across this way, and then the other one goes. At right angles to it. And we've also got a move which enables a hole to be formed. You can drill a hole in the middle of one of these vertices and produce basically a new link that runs from here to here. Now, this is heading towards the question of developing some way of calculating amplitudes of process, because these sorts of processes should underlie the split. If we can turn the crossings of these things into the gradings of the helons, then these processes should underlie the dynamics of the helons. And if we can associate, we have amplitudes associated with each process, then we should be able to carry those over into the helon framework. We're also trying to determine some sort of conserved quantities. Now, since the ribbons that we're dealing with have width, we can exchange crossings for twists. So if we just had a one-dimensional structure like this that was twisted around itself, that deforms nice and smoothly into this ring. But if you had the equivalent object formed out of ribbons, untwisted or uncrossed, and you get you acquire twists on the two sides of this band that we've now formed. So there's something that's been carried over. Right. There's some quantity which represents which is related to both how these strands cross over top of each other, but also what twists they carry on them, and that should be a conserved quantity which we can identify no matter what the actual configuration that we're looking at any given time is. So we're interested in finding quantities which are conserved under the action of the local moves that I showed you on the previous slide. Right. So topologists and mathematicians in the audience, we're open to suggestions. And such quantities, we would expect, are going to be constants in time. So as time goes by, these things are going to be conserved. So.
Doesn't one of these things just specify the discretization of the rubens for this? Triangulation of the rubens?
Yeah, I believe so.
So we didn't know exactly what they did with this?
Well, Lee, you're probably more qualified to answer that question than I am.
I'm a triangulation
of the ring surface.
Of a
ring surface, too, like some potential parenting.
Yeah, rather than thinking of them as ribbons, you can think of them as ring surfaces as well, as two dimensional tubes.
Right, so it's just like a little line. Grass.
Yeah. Might as well detail me.
Yeah. There might be some difficulty with treating these things as tubes rather than rhythms. It's possible that the team and me and I have different sort of things on that issue. We won't get into that. Okay, so what remains to be done? The problems that we have to face, the questions that have popped up in this talk, are the following. So we've got some very encouraging results, but we still don't have an explanation for the P-bundling and neutrino oscillations. The process that I showed you before with muon decay seems to indicate that generations should not be violated. You shouldn't have any process that takes you from a second generation fermion to a first generation or a third generation to a second generation. But we know that happens in the real world, so we need to come up with some mechanism by which this can happen. And hopefully that would allow us to actually calculate the Cabebo angles from first principles, which would be a very nice result. It would also be nice, because we haven't assumed that these things have any mass, it would be very nice if there was some way some simple formula that just said, hey, look at a braid, look at how many crossings there are in it, look at how many twists there are in it, plug into the formula, bang, out pops the mass of the corresponding particle. That would be really nice. Unfortunately, any formula we've got so far have been too simple. But there are large uncertainties in the experimental values for the quark masses, so it's not always easy to know whether you're feeding the right data. Like I said, we've eliminated spin from the links in the loop from the gravity framework. So what would be really nice is if the spin that we measure for fermions and bosons actually emerges at the level of the braiding. So is there some way to say that a structure, a braid, like I showed you for the fermions, is spin half, and when you combine these things, you get spin one structures, and they can have spins that are plus one, zero, minus one. For the bosons, it would be really, really nice. There's not a question of anomalies, which we won't deal with quite yet. And we'd like to know what the rules govern the formations of higher generations, and whether or not those rules imply an upper limit. So, in conclusion, we started off with just simple lines for edges. We went really for incredibly simple basic objects. We had a very small set of rules inspired by topology that we're all familiar with from, you know, playing with pieces of paper in kindergarten or something. And we didn't need to assume spin, charge, mass, or anything that was used in the Richon model. What we've achieved is that we've got all of the first generation fermions with the correct color and electrical charges. We don't have any extra particles, right? There's at least for the first generation, there's no extra stuff that pops up in the model that we don't see in the real world. And we've got this nice result that we have only left-handed neutrinos. We've got quantities that look like lepton number, baryon number, and half charge. And we can describe the electromagnetic leak and color interactions in a pretty simple, straightforward manner. It might be naive, it might look naive, but then again, this is a model.
Sorry, again, at level one, where you think everything works, do you get exactly the right interactions? You showed one example, but if you go through all the possible ones according to some rules that haven't fully told us, but which you've worked out, do you get exactly the allowed interactions in some model, or do you get more interactions or less interactions?
Okay. I can tell you the rules. The rules really are that when you split or join a boson off from a braid, that boson has to have a net integer charge. Right? So it either has to have zero charge, three pluses, three minuses, or one plus, one minus, and zero. And that's really it. And that gives you all the correct interactions. There's a little bit of a query as to whether or not we get the correct coupling of left-handed quark states as opposed to right-handed quark states. Certainly it's true in the case of the leptons, because there simply is no right-handed neutrino to couple with. And anti-neutrino. So that issue of the quarks is the only possible mingle. But apart from that, it's all plain. So the current goal is at least to try to adapt the Hillman model into the framework of loop quantum gravity. That would be nice because it means that loop quantum gravity would have a way of producing matter and the other forces besides gravity. So it's successful. That will incorporate gravity and space-time within the standard model. Simplify LQG, possibly, because we're eliminating some of the quantum numbers, some of the labels on the links, and ultimately give us a description of space-time, matter, and the four forces based upon geometry, without the need for extra dimensions, extra particles, or any of that other stuff that I said I didn't like about things like extreme theory and supersymmetry, and I think that would be pretty good. So, thank you.
Questions, maybe other people who haven't asked questions yet, give them a lot of questions. So people who haven't asked questions.
I've been doing this for a while, but at some point there was this thing called the dual stand-up model.
which was the idea that if you look at monopole, so basically solitary models with monopoles, can actually reproduce those quantum numbers as well.
Okay.
I don't keep looking for these. But it's basically the topological charge of monopoles can also be able to reproduce various numbers of quarks and left. And maybe there is a reason, there is a connection between, at least a group theory connection between what is obtained there. I don't know if you're looking for that.
Yeah, no, I hadn't thought that's an interesting possibility to present.
If you said you've got graphs without labels anymore, so if you just think of the twist as a label, as a plus or minus sign attached to the arc, right, then you can just say you're replacing spins by plus or minus. You're replacing the integers by plus or minus.
Well, it can be plus 2, plus 3.
Yeah, okay, by integers. Right, so then I don't see this that much different from the spin network, it's just a different group. Like.
But
my question is...
You'll notice the word possibly.
Yeah. Right. But my question is that as far as your sort of numerology, before you discuss gravity is concerned, there it wouldn't matter if it was a ribbon or if it was just a label, right? It could just be an integer label. And so the difference is if it really is a ribbon as opposed to an integer label, that would show up when you start considering these topological configurations that you mentioned when you discussed quantum gravity. So there, probably the ribbon invariance would show up. That would be different from simply having a graph with labels. Because the things you can do with twists, with ribbons, if you're just considering braids, as if you just have braids with a label. But if you're considering, it's knots and things, then that's now different. So but it wouldn't show up on the level of your prion models. Is that right?
I think that's correct. I might have to stop and think about it and have a strong other blackboard with you.
When you first wrote out of it, I was
It's on the extensive to-do list. I've been here for 2 weeks. But I don't expect to unify gravity with the other three forces and matter and geometry in 2 weeks.
Just to kind of, we have an expert on the topological statistics here with Raphael. So I don't know if you know.
I wasn't planning to comment on that. Because I thought of it, but I couldn't see the connection because those things would be space-time diagrams in the groups that I know, but here they're just spatial things. But I did want to ask a question. So if you're aiming to embed your first model into the loop quantum gravity framework, what plays the role of these little tabletops on which the braids began and ended?
Ah, right. Okay. Those little tabletops are actually just other legs of vertices. Okay, so you can imagine having a four-valent vertex, right? Taking these three legs and doing something with them, like so. Meanwhile, this leg here goes off and connects into the rest of the network. It does whatever. It basically serves to anchor the whole thing down. But then, of course, you've got the moves.
That'll pin them down. But I thought you had processes in which the sort of two tabletops merged that disappeared.
Yeah.
I don't see quite what the analog of that would be.
Right.
In this network system.
Yeah. The analog of that would be some sort of set of local moves that enabled you to do something like. Say we're talking about splitting. Joining is probably a little bit more difficult to get away with if you're talking about local moves. But say you've got something like that and you punch a couple of holes in it there, right? So that's just two iterations of the second of those local moves that I use. Now, if you've then got if there's some condition which enables twists from here to be inherited over here, maybe the the process of producing a whole isn't as classical as it seems. Maybe there's some way that the twist gets carried through in this process. But you could then have, you know, this structure forming, expanding out, but this section here shrinking down to form like a waist, essentially. Pinches off, pinches in here, and then the two of them can separate out. So something like that at a first approximation would be our best guess for how you start to produce these sorts of splitting and joining operations.
Yeah. The standard model is more than just a set of quantum numbers. It is a local field theory which enables you to calculate. So is there any way in which you can derive a local field theory out of this? Are these things spread out all over the space, or in which case, how do you derive something like the local field theory that standard model?
I could see that if these things are present within some sort of a spin net, some sort of a network from which you can derive a space-time structure, then you would expect to have these non-trivial structures forming and annihilating in pairs at various points throughout space. So you would get something like a field with excitations and creation, annihilation operator, raising, lowering operators going on all over throughout the field. So you would have virtual pairs of quantum analogies. So you'd have sort of the rudiments of quantum field theory. That would be the direction that I would sort of be investigating. But
shouldn't that be your first priority before you decide?
Well, it might be that unifying with gravity is actually the path to that. I mean, if you're designing a car, where do you start? Sometimes you have to invent all of the bits at the same time to make it work. Yeah, it might be that we have to actually merge this into gravity and then everything else will drop out.
This is a similar question. I mean, is there any chance this composite of similar quarks and leptons could, for example, be seen with the LHC? Or more generally, the energy scale, you have the plate, are we to imagine the binding is a plate scale, in which case it will be forever invisible, or do you imagine the sort of a scale which is much lower than the
plate
scale,
where these
things might appear
comfortable?
Is that a good question?
It's a good question.
I've already got W dragons, so that'll be a flood scale.
Yeah. The weak scale itself has to enter as shelter, it has to be weight set. Yeah. There's some mass scales, or not? Well, the plate scale is there. Zero mass.
Yeah. I'm afraid I'm going to actually have to put that in the large list of we don't knows. I don't want to make a definitive statement about that because, once again, this is still speculative. It's you know, 2 weeks worth of taking a static model and then trying to turn it into something that actually exists within space time. So, you know, we've got to do this, but. It's a completely different type of coupling to what we used to dealing with. So all bets may be off.
Only on that note, because I feel I start to feel a little restlessness in the room. Sundance is here to rest this week, and we hope to do this maybe stay a little longer. So there is lots of time still to discuss the questions. And that's it. Yeah. Thank you.